Production support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm your host, Kate Young. On our show this week, a discussion on the relationship between a restaurant's tipping policy and sexual harassment of waitstaff. We talk with restaurant owner Dave Stockwell and find out what it's like to go from designing buildings to running a restaurant. And we have a pesto recipe with a surprising ingredient, carrot tops. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. First, Alex Chambers with a few stories that caught our attention this week.
Hey, Kate.
Hey, Alex.
2 weeks ago, we reported on the staggering rates of suicide among American farmers. This week, we're happy to report House Bill 2671, which establishes a pilot program for free suicide prevention for employees of the agriculture industry, unanimously passed the House of Representatives in Washington State. Washington State legislators aren't the only ones taking action to prevent more farmer suicides. Dairy co-op Agrimark appears to be trying to redeem itself after its role in a national price-fixing scheme by encouraging its members to take advantage of mental health programs. As milk prices continue to drop for the third year in a row and New England winters challenge the region's farmers, Agrimark sent a letter to its New England members saying the co-op is in the process of creating a, quote, free, comprehensive member assistance program and listed resources available to farmers in the meantime. The resources include FarmNet in New York, Farm First in Vermont, the Maine Crisis Hotline, and the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And there could be changes afoot for people receiving SNAP benefits. Under President Trump's 2019 budget, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program would start providing about half its benefits to low-income Americans in the form of pre-selected packages instead of financial assistance. Those SNAP benefits would arrive in what the USDA called a harvest box of non-perishable American-grown food. The package would consist of, quote, shelf-stable milk, ready-to-eat cereals, pasta, peanut butter, beans, canned meats, and canned fruit and vegetables. The boxes would not include fresh fruit or vegetables. Currently, SNAP beneficiaries can use the benefits to choose their own groceries within current USDA guidelines. The administration says the move is a cost-effective approach with, quote, no loss in food benefits to participants. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue highlighted a desire for states to have increased flexibility in administering SNAP. But the University of Chicago's Bruce Meyer, who's studied food stamp policy for 20 years, says the current system of putting money on benefit cards is already inexpensive and flexible. He thinks the new proposal might be a way for, quote, food businesses that have excess food to get it off their warehouse shelves. Nutrition programs like SNAP make up 80% of the USDA's budget in the most recent Farm Bill. About 44 million people participated in SNAP each month in 2016. Nearly two-thirds were under 18, over 60, or disabled, according to the USDA. It isn't clear whether the harvest boxes would come with directions on how to cook the food inside. Thanks to Taylor Killow and Harvest Public Media for those stories.
Thank you, Alex.
No problem, Kate.
Next, we go to the kitchen with Chef Arlen Llewellyn. Llewellyn is the chef at Function Brewing in Bloomington, Indiana. Today, she shares a recipe made with carrot tops. Llewellyn came by this recipe idea through a conversation with a farmer at Freedom Valley Farm.
talking to him about carrots, and he said, well, do you want to do anything with the tops? Because I've got a bunch of those. And I looked at him, and he's like, they make a great pesto. And it turns out that's a whole thing, but I didn't know anything about that. Yeah, that the farmers have great ideas for how to use their produce. And so really encourage anybody to talk to the person that they're buying those vegetables from at the market, because they can give you some really interesting insights.
So to answer the question that might be running through your mind right now, yes, carrot tops are edible.
Absolutely. They are completely safe to eat, and they taste very much like a carrot, as well as a green vegetable at the same time.
You're probably familiar with the traditional pesto, but you might not know how versatile pesto can be.
So pesto, as you may know, is an amazing base recipe because it's a simple ratio of ingredients, and you can substitute almost any aspect of those out. So you can use almost any leafy vegetable for the basil. You can use almost any form of acid for the lemon juice, any form of nut for the pine nuts that are traditionally in it. So we use aged Gouda instead of Parmesan. We use that in a couple different components in our recipes in-house, and I think it makes a great addition to pesto. And cashews, which we use instead of pine nuts. I would hold off on adding any of the oil, because you really want this hard stuff to be forced to be broken down by the food processor blade. If you start adding oil in there, it's just going to swim around the blade rather than being broken down. All right, I'm going to start grinding this up, pulsing it. Adding the oil in. So that's the reason for the handy little hole at the top of the food processor, is to be able to do something like this. Also, how you would do, for instance, mayonnaise, is to just stream it in very slowly. I am a really improvisational cook. I think that's what I really enjoy, is being able to put things together and taste it and just keep experimenting. The specials are really my opportunity to play, and I do. We have a different soup and a different sandwich every week, and I can just experiment a little bit.
Chef Llewellyn incorporates this pesto into one of her signature sandwich specials. Here's a list of what's on it.
We have a raisin aioli, the carrot top pesto, roasted carrots, braised collard greens, blue cheese, and Havarti on multigrain bread, and then we put the pickled jalapenos on the side. I try to always build the flavors of sandwiches up from the bottom, knowing that, you know, this piece of bread is going to hit your tongue, and then you have all these things that come up from there. And that's a nice thing about sandwiches, is that as a chef, is that you can control how the customer is going to experience it. Whereas if you're putting things on a plate and they're just diving in with a knife and fork, they may not eat it in the sequence that you would want them to. In a sandwich, they're kind of forced to.
Since the sandwich specials are always changing at Function, you probably can't get your hands on this one at the moment. But hey, you could whip up some carrot top pesto and see if you can build something similar at home. Experiment, have fun, and find the pesto recipe at eartheats.org. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers on Bloomington's east side corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. My guest on Earth Eats today is Dave Stockwell. He's the owner of Fawn Restaurant in Brooklyn, New York, and I spoke with him on the phone. Dave Stockwell and I were in school together years ago. and he'd been working in a high-powered architecture firm in New York for over a decade when he announced the opening of this new restaurant. So again, the restaurant's called Fawn, and it's located on Vanderbilt Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. Big change. Major life shift. And we'll get to that, to what that's been like for him. But first, I want to get to why I called him for an Earth Eats interview. When Stockwell opened Fawn, he opened as a gratuity-free house. And what that means is that tips are included in the price listed on the menu. He paid servers a significantly higher base wage and also included a revenue sharing plan where servers and kitchen staff would receive a portion of the sales on a given night. I was interested in what drove him to that decision. Lately, I've been thinking about the environment of restaurants and what a tipping policy might have to do with how waitstaff are treated in a restaurant. It was on my mind, with all the recent revelations of sexual harassment and assault in the restaurant industry. I know this kind of conduct is rampant in all sorts of fields. That's becoming more and more evident with each day that goes by. But I've been wondering, does the tipping structure set up an environment that is particularly conducive to harassment? I'm not the only one thinking about this. This week, restaurant workers held a #NotOnTheMenu rally in Seattle, Washington, linking the low wages in the restaurant industry with sexual harassment. The demonstrators are raising awareness about the federal subminimum wage for tipped workers, which remains at $2.13 an hour, where it has been stuck for more than 20 years. While most states do pay tipped restaurant workers more, 17 states still pay the federal minimum of $2.13 per hour. The combination of low base pay, lack of reliable schedule, and dependence on tips from customers makes servers particularly vulnerable to sexual harassment and abuse, and less likely to speak up about it due to the financial instability of restaurant work. The precarious relationship between servers and customers played into Dave Stockwell's initial tipping policy when he opened Fawn in 2016.
Certainly there's been an ongoing conversation about the tipping policy, namely restaurants that have waitstaff that operates and works for tips, that opens them up to feel like they have to accept a certain amount of sexual harassment from guests to them for fear that they would, you know, lose some of their tip if they don't just put up with it. And that's, you know, that certainly was among the list of things that I looked at when I made the decision, when we opened, to operate as a gratuity-free house.
Stockwell had other reasons, too. He didn't like the wage disparity that happens when waitstaff are tipped, but line cooks and dishwashers are not. He wanted the back of house to share in the rewards of working hard on busy nights. He also wanted to be straightforward with customers. The price on the menu is the price you pay. We aren't expecting more after you've had a few glasses of wine. And something else compelled him to try a no-tip policy.
There have been plenty of conversations about the rates at which different types of people are tipped. You can certainly see there are racial issues at play. People of color have generally been tipped less than white people in this country. Certainly didn't want to participate in anything that was going to create any kind of a racial barrier to how well people were going to get their tips. There's also, you know, this idea that a certain kind of body type might attract more tips than someone of a different kind of body type. Also, I mean, that touches on the sexual harassment idea somewhat as well, which, you know, also plays into the idea that someone who will be a little more flirtatious might tease out a little bit more of a tip than someone who plays a little more straight and professional.
But as you might have guessed, since we've been talking about this in the past tense, Stockwell's restaurant did not remain gratuity-free. At the start of 2018, he switched to the standard tipping policy. I asked him what drove the change.
That's pretty simple. It comes down to really economics. With all of the merits and all of the reasons that I fundamentally believe it is in everyone's best interest to look forward beyond this traditional tipping method, it still remains very much the way people expect to go out to restaurants, and it's how they expect to look at the pricing on menus when they're looking online, whether they're looking on the menu in your window of the restaurant. And it subconsciously and sometimes very consciously determines their purchasing behavior. And it just really came down to, despite the fact that I had a good niche following of people that were really supportive of what we were doing and just really commended us for taking that step. It's not easy for a small independent operator to kind of pull that cart when not many people are doing it. The truth of the matter is there weren't enough of them that would come in with that as a selling point. And I was getting a sensibility from just being on the ground and hearing or seeing people react to menu prices and understanding that they may not be coming in the door or they may be ordering a little lighter than they would otherwise. And then, you know, seeing very simple interactions where people go to pay and they say, hey, I don't see where I'm supposed to leave my tip on this receipt.
So they just weren't even getting it. They weren't.
So you understand that they, you know, you can write it all over the place, but they weren't looking at it. So you realize, wow, there's a lot of people that aren't even seeing this. They just think our prices are 20% higher than other restaurants for a similarly ambitious product. And you know that then they're not seeing the difference, that you're not actually asking them to pay more at the end of your experience. If they're not getting that, there's a lot of people not coming in the door based on that.
He realized that as a small, relatively new restaurant, he couldn't continue to swim against the tide. So the servers now get the sub-minimum base wage, which is $8.65 an hour for most places in New York. He says the servers are elated. It sounded like they were tolerating the previous policy, even though they didn't make as much money as they could with tips, because there were other things that they liked about working at Fawn. Now that they're getting the tips, they are very pleased. He's compensating the kitchen staff a bit more to even things out, but notes that everyone's happier when the restaurant is busy, which it has been. When we spoke, it had only been a month since he changed the policy, the month of January, which is historically the worst month for restaurants in New York. And he'd already noticed a difference. Even on slow weeks, they are seeing profit margins they hadn't seen before.
The difference is huge. I didn't want it to be that way,
but
it is. And you have to accept that and say, okay, well, at least now I have the ability. I mean, I can actually pay the back of house more now, even if there's some more inequality between the front of house and back of house. They're all on par. I'm able to have them all do better. You know, you kick over a little bit. I'm just trying to replace with wage what I was giving them in their commissions. I have every intention to keep that raise going, but I have quite a mountain of debt to tackle that partly has to do with operating at a gratuity-free restaurant for a year and a half. So I need to be measured about, maintaining payments in all different directions. The back of house, I'd have to say, is supportive, too, because everybody who works in the restaurant wants to work in a busy restaurant. People don't want to work in a restaurant that's struggling.
So David Stockwell has made his peace with the way things are, for now. I wanted to turn the conversation back to sexual harassment and to the culture of restaurant kitchens. Some of the stories that I've heard, people who've been in the industry for a long time just talking about how it's really a part of kitchen culture and restaurant culture that it can get a little bit rowdy and that, you know, flirtation or off-color humor is really can be a part of what makes it fun to work in a restaurant and the kind of late nights and after hours partying. And, you know, I've just been thinking about, is it possible to preserve some of what's good about that? I mean, it clearly like it builds a community and camaraderie and still keep things from crossing over into violation and or humiliation or power moves or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope to think that there's people can find that balance. I mean, generally speaking, I would say there are ways of being silly and raucous without offending people.
Stockwell has a clearly stated zero tolerance policy around sexual harassment, and it's outlined in his employee manual. He says that so far he hasn't had any issues with sexual harassment come up in his restaurant.
I haven't witnessed sexual harassment, but I've certainly heard off-color humor come out on multiple occasions that sometimes is really funny, but it's also, it could be offensive. Still a lot of macho stuff that goes on in kitchen culture, even if it's not sexual harassment per se.
Well, and I also just wonder, too, if, as with most of these types of issues, is power at the heart of all of it? And I think that, you know, it's really a problem when someone who has power over someone else is the one who's doing the harassing or the... I mean, I know it can be among peers as well, but it just seems like the biggest problems come when people have power and they're abusing it. So
sure. Yeah, and I can't say that our kitchen is innocent of that. I mean, certainly... A lot of these off-color jokes can come right out of the chef's mouth, and I'm quite certain that the line cooks don't feel the same freedom to spout that kind of thing back to him. You know, so there's absolutely a power issue there. I have the sense that he tries to do it in a way that's, you know, sometimes you're just trying to break the ice and get people to loosen up.
Right.
But at the same time, if people don't fully understand where he's coming from, you know, it could probably put them in a slightly uncomfortable situation, even if they don't acknowledge it.
We talked about how a raucous, macho environment might not feel welcoming to everyone, even if the line is not crossed into sexual harassment. And we asked about what the role of the restaurant owner might be in creating an environment that is respectful to everyone. Stockwell noted that he might need to offer some verbal reminders to back up his written policies, especially when someone new comes on.
You know, just so that you know that it's went through their brain again, you say, hey, look, there's zero tolerance for any kind of harassment on site. I would just, you know, you need to know that that's where we stand. So, you know, I probably should be a little more vocal about that.
Do you have anything to add about this topic? Tipping, sexual harassment, respect in the restaurant industry? Just small topics.
just that I feel like progress is being made. It's good news that just like in the film industry and the media all over the place, these issues are being shaken out in a much bigger way than they have before in the past 6 months. That's a good thing. It's a bigger step in a faster time span than we've seen. It can only mean good things for the industry in terms of making it a better place to work overall. So I'm fully on board with promoting as much awareness about it as possible.
Before we got off the phone, I had to ask, how's it going? What has it been like to take such a giant leap from architect to restaurateur? He talked about the long hours, about regretting the time away from his family. He has a 4-year-old daughter. And we talked about what it means to follow this dream of his, of having a restaurant. So you're following a dream, and where is the dream part coming in right now? Like, where is the joy that you're finding in it, or the like, yeah, I'm so glad I'm doing this right now?
Well, I can't say that I'm sitting there saying that a lot. Sometimes I'm saying, what in the world have I done? I had a career that was going pretty well. I had a very enviable job in a fancy pants architecture firm, working on cool projects all over the world. And now I'm fixing plumbing in the basement half the time.
Yeah, half, you know, the time.
Trying to track down someone's lost paycheck, or, you know, there's just so many little things that drive you crazy day in and day out, and I'm the one that has to deal with it all.
But Stockwell admits once all the details of the day are dealt with and the restaurant opens, he really enjoys the hands-on part of being in the restaurant. The contact with the guests and the community he sees taking shape in this space that he's made possible.
We've created a place for community to become tighter and get to know each other better. You know, that's the ultimate. I mean, that's why I decided, okay, it's worth stepping out of this firm where I'm working on big abstract projects that are overseas. I want to work on something where I can actually see the effects and be a part of promoting the positive effects that I'm seeking in a space. But to me, it is also an architectural, you know, there's a continuum between what I'm doing here and what I was doing in a firm working on design.
Just
a little bit more immediate. There's an urban part of it. There's, you know, you want to be a part of shaping the life up and down the street that we're on, and you know, being a positive change in that neighborhood. So you know, it's this idea of plugging yourself into the local community, the place where I live, and getting to know the people on a much more intimate level, and getting to understand the workings of a space, and seeing the direct results of decisions you make, positive or negative. But really, you know, there's something much more hands-on and immediate about that. That's yeah. kind of soul-satisfying. You know, your nervous system is right there, feeling it day in and day out in a way that it wasn't while working on buildings far away that I might not even ever visit. When I can really stand back and think about it in that light, that's where it all still makes sense to me that I'm doing this, despite the fact that it's a pain in the ass on a day-to-day.
Yeah, that really does make a lot of sense. And then there's also the food. I mean, you're involved with food every day.
Yeah, I forget. I'm kind of a foodie guy. I've never cooked less or eaten less than when I've owned a restaurant. People look at me and say, wow, you've lost weight. What, you have a restaurant. What's going on?
Like, when would I possibly have time to eat? Thanks to David Stockwell for taking the time to talk with me and for tackling some of the tough issues in the industry right now. This is only one piece of a much larger conversation, and one that I hope to continue having here on Earth Eats from multiple perspectives. Tune in for more voices in the coming weeks weighing in on sexual harassment and assault in the food world, on what's changing and what's slow to change. In the meantime, look for news, resources, and links on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Shout out to the Earth Eats team for everything you do to keep us going. That includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Arlen Llewellyn, Annie Corrigan, and David Stockwell. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Thanks for joining us on Earth Eats today. I'm Kate Young. We'll be back next week.